Well, please, you can ask intelligent questions if you want.
We are going to begin this meeting of this cost containment work group. We have three items on our agenda this afternoon, and Representative Abler and I are confident that we can move through these things in a
kind way for the interest of people's time.
Move it right along. And so I think we'll just, before we begin, I want to call to the members' attention. You would have all received an email earlier today about a healthcare forum that's being held tomorrow in Rochester at the Mayo Clinic. And I understand that there will be some good, thoughtful, provocative information being presented. And so we wanted to make that available. If you are able to attend, I'm sure that they would welcome you. If you are unable to attend, I have it on pretty good authority that they will be inclined to share some of that good information with us as we move forward. With that, I think we'll start with item number one on the agenda. That's prostate cancer screening. At this time, I'd like to welcome Mr. James Eng to come forward. And my introduction in this will be very short and sweet. There was a bill introduced last session. It's noted on your agenda. And it was just that. It was introduced. As we were discussing things along the lines of cost containment and proactive things that we could do, this was something that surfaced that we thought might be pertinent that we review. I will say that, at least on the Senate side, this bill was not heard in any committee. So for many of us, this will be the first time that this has really been heard. And with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Eng to share with us some information on prostate cancer screening. Mr. Eng, welcome.
Thank you. Senator Lynch and Representative Abler and other members of the commission, I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss a proposal which I believe can reduce the impact of the costs of health care as seen by the uninsured patient and by the providers of health care services to that patient. As a prostate cancer survivor, I have developed a concern about a group of men who have the same disease, but whose experiences with the disease may be different than mine, and who are often not recognized, uninsured men. I was diagnosed and treated for prostate cancer in 1995 at age 64. My cancer was discovered as a result of a screening exam, and fortunately was diagnosed early enough so that it could be treated before it had spread. Today, I consider myself cured. Having had a very good experience, I was very troubled to find that many men were unaware of the threat of prostate cancer. I felt compelled to do something to combat this lack of understanding, and together with another survivor, who is a retired physician, I started giving free talks about the importance of screening and early detection. The reason we give these talks is prostate cancer is the most common non-skin cancer. It cannot be prevented. One out of every six men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during their lifetime. However, if prostate cancer is detected early enough, before symptoms are present, it can be cured. Screening is an exam that looks for a disease before there are any symptoms. It is a particularly critical exam for prostate cancer because the disease can be cured during that early stage when there are no symptoms. However, the presence of symptoms usually means that prostate cancer has progressed to the stage where it is incurable. At that stage, it can be treated, but not cured. That is why screening is critical. We offer these free talks to any audience that will hear us, including Kiwanis and Rotary Clubs, church groups, the Senior Center, labor unions, religious, national, and ethnic groups. Upon returning from one of these sessions where the audience was low income and some were probably uninsured, my physician friend told me that he could no longer ethically continue to talk to that kind of group. because he was urging them to seek screening. But when they came to him for help in obtaining it, there was no program or place he could identify in southeastern Minnesota that would provide a free screening exam. Let me pause here for a moment. One out of six of the men who are present here today, and by extension, one out of six of the men and boys who are represented here today by their wives, mothers, or other family members, can expect to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. Now, I can pause. Five of you can line up behind me. That'll cover you, but the rest of you are on your own. There is no way to prevent it. The important question then is, will it be diagnosed early enough so that you can be cured? Screening attempts to do just that. I hope that all of you men and all of those other men are being screened annually, which is appropriate. If you are insured, you are guaranteed coverage for screening by Minnesota state law. Minnesota Statute 62Q50 requires that health plans cover prostate cancer screening. Thus, the majority of men, those who are insured, have guaranteed access to screening for early detection. Only the uninsured minority does not have that government guaranteed access. In contrast, Minnesota has a program called SAGE, which since 1991 has provided free annual breast and cervical cancer screening for uninsured women. This is an important and successful program that Minnesota should be proud of, and it must be continued, ensuring that both insured and uninsured women have access to annual breast and cervical cancer screening in our state. There is no similar free prostate cancer screening program for uninsured men in Minnesota. The result of this is that the uninsured man will probably not see a doctor until symptoms compel him. I'm sure you recognize that this kind of delay occurs for all uninsured persons, for all diseases. But in the case of prostate cancer, that delay has a deadly and expensive outcome. Symptoms usually mean that the cancer has spread beyond the prostate, at which point these men's cancers usually cannot be cured. A different treatment plan will have to be used for those patients, much more involved than the usual surgery or radiation used for curative therapy. The ongoing total lifetime cost for advanced prostate cancer is significantly greater than the cost of treatment for cancer that is confined and cured, possibly double or even more depending on the treatment and duration involved. And that cost does not measure the lost earnings or the impact, both economic and emotional, to his family and to society. If, instead of delaying the diagnosis of prostate cancer, an uninsured man could obtain an annual screening exam, his cancer may be detected while it is still curable. He could be treated and cured and returned to a normal, productive life with his family. Out of recognition of that fact, early detection can save lives as well as result in reduced cost of treatment. And the moment of truth when my physician friend expressed his concern about ethics, this proposed legislation was born. I contacted members of the legislature to urge that Minnesota should provide men with an opportunity for free prostate cancer screening, similar to what women have available through the SAGE program. Senator Lynch has introduced Senate File 2091, which would provide this screening. And Representative Welty has introduced a companion bill, House File 2319. This is a simple bill. It does not provide treatment. It only provides screening exams and, if needed, a biopsy. It will not increase the number of cases that need treatment. They can't be prevented. But it will provide an opportunity for the treatment to begin earlier when a cure may still be possible. The available treatment programs for the uninsured man will be the same, whether he has screening and early detection or not. But the relative extent and cost of treatment will be substantially reduced by detecting prostate cancer before it is spread. I don't know if the Department of Health has yet provided a cost analysis of this bill. With the help of others, I have completed a very preliminary estimate of cost using Medicare reimbursement rates. The estimate is for direct reimbursement and does not include any Department of Health Administration costs. The estimate shows that there are about 22,000 uninsured men in the age bracket affected by this bill. And assuming a 50% participation rate, it shows an overall annual cost of about $830,000 to provide free screening to 11,000 uninsured men, an average cost of about $75 per man. I cannot estimate the cost of the additional lifetime treatment, that which is over and above the cost of early stage treatment, which might have been used for these if these men were seen at an early stage. However, that additional cost of treatment could equal or exceed this cost estimate. And the cost estimate does not include any consideration of lost earnings for the patient or the financial impact on the surviving family or the economic impact to society. No treatment or vaccine or other preventative measure has yet been developed to reduce the incidence of prostate cancer. And in fact, Minnesota is expected to see a rise in the number of cases of prostate cancer from 4,200 in 2006 to 4,800 in 2007, even as the rest of the nation sees a total decline. Now, this rise may be due to a change in the database structure used to gather the numbers. I don't think this is an indication of epidemic, but simply a recalculation. New calculation. I urge you to recognize this concern and to support this opportunity to reduce the personal impact of the disease, as well as the cost to public and private programs that will be called upon to support the uninsured man when his cancer is finally found and must be treated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hale. Questions or comments?
Was there a fiscal note in there?
In the Senate, we never heard, this bill was not heard. So, so the answer is no, not in the Senate.
And the math that we got, that would be front unloaded, so there'd be a population, and then there'd be just a trickle of people coming in. So it'd probably be a front end fiscal note with some. The ongoing cost would be cheaper, I think, than the startup cost. Because if there's 22,000 people in that age group, then a minority of that size would people would come in as they turn 50. So it'd be a startup number, I would bet.
22,000 is based on a 2004 analysis by the state of uninsured. And that percentage that they arrived at was applied to the population age distribution for the year 2005. To develop that 22,000. So I would consider that to be a representative number for that for going forward from that population base, 2005. Now, the question that is reasonable to ask there is the 50% population, or is the 50% participation rate. In the materials that I have distributed to you, you'll find one sheet which shows a range of participation figures from about, I think it's 40% to over 60%. That depends upon urban or rural location and upon education bracket. So I think I'm a bit optimistic in assuming 50%. But
Dr. Bershaw had a question.
Dr. Bershaw.
Yeah. Let me just preface by saying this is an important subject for me because my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer this summer and treated. So I'm certainly sympathetic, empathetic. But I think this is one of those areas where science doesn't necessarily support what it is that seems intuitive, that while a PSA screening might detect cancer years before it would otherwise be detected with a digital examination or symptoms, that may only be creating added lead time where the patients know they have cancer. For example, if I develop cancer in the year 2000, was screened at that time, but I died in the year 2010, I would have a 10-year life expectancy after screening. Whereas if I hadn't done any screening, maybe next year I would have had symptoms in 2008, and I would have died in 2010 and had only a 2-year life expectancy. So it makes it seem like screening increases the life expectancy fivefold, and in fact, it may not do that. And there is, in addition to the cost of screening, cost of workup, cost of treatment, both in terms of money and also morbidity and mortality rates. And the evidence so far just isn't there. We're expecting some big studies coming down the pike soon that may help clarify, but it's for this reason that I believe the U.S. Preventative Disease Task Force has taken no position that prostate cancer screening is or is not worthwhile. And a study of 10,000 men in Scandinavia showed no difference in outcome with screening and treatment. So not saying we shouldn't go there, but we may be a year premature until further studies come out that help tell us what the science is behind early screening and treatment.
Thank you.
May I respond?
Mr. Eng.
The PLCO cancer screening trial being run by NCI is underway. It intends to enroll about 148,000 patients, and it's going to be looking for prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer outcome. My understanding of that trial is that they had, as of April 2000, concluded an enrollment of 144,000, so close to their goal, but it's a 13-year observation period for each person, depending upon following randomization. So even at 2000, if the trial was closed, 13 years later would indicate that we are quite a ways, more than a year, away from having any results that I believe U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is looking for. There's also the question about whether or not a man wants to live with cancer once he's been diagnosed with it by biopsy. If you're diagnosed with it this year, you might be content. The next man might not. And so there's a choice there. Screening is the only tool that we have to detect prostate cancer. I urge you to recognize that we don't have any other tool. We need to support, we need to give the men who have prostate cancer same kind of support that we give to women who have breast and cervical cancer, the opportunity to make a choice. This bill does not require, does not compel either the patient or the doctor to actively become involved. It only offers an insured man the same opportunity that you or any of the other men in this room have who have insurance.
Thank you, Mr. Eng. Ms. Sexton.
You know, I had a question regarding the SAGE screening program. Is that in legislation too, or how was that established? And I mean, I guess what I'm getting at was
good question. And I'm going to ask Margaret Kelly is here from the department, and she had indicated that she had some comments that I think she's going to make along those lines.
Perfect.
So
thank
we'll
you.
See if this answers your question, Ms. Kelly. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name for the record is Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health, and I'm here as in my capacity as Chief Financial Officer to answer questions about the funding. I do have some information about our SAGE program and about a new grant that we have received for prostate cancer early detection. We have, if you, handout is coming around, and when you see it, you'll see in the second paragraph that the federal government, through the Center for Disease Control, has funded breast and cervical cancer screening as part of a national program since 1991. And so the majority of our funding for the SAGE program comes through the federal government. In about 1998, the legislature augmented that funding to ensure that we would have better coverage for women. The federal program covers certain categories of women, certain age groups based on insurance. So some women who are uninsured or underinsured or of a specific age may not have coverage through the federal program. And so the state funding kind of wraps around the federal funding to increase the number of women who are eligible for the program. We also get a little over $500,000 a year from the Twin Cities Race for the Cure, which is the part of the Susan G. Komen Foundation. So that's the funding picture for our SAGE program.
I think that's helpful. And so, Ms. Kelly, currently there are no federal dollars that are available as there are in the SAGE program for prostate cancer screening.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There is not a federal program for screening for prostate cancer, but we did just receive a federal grant, $170,000 a year for 5 years. We're in the process of finalizing a contract with the American Cancer Society to do some consumer education and consumer outreach around encouraging people to get prostate cancer screening. One of the dilemmas at the federal level, and this is not stating the Department of Health's position, but simply to reflect for your purposes the conversations at the federal level with Dr. Bershaw referred to, is that there is not agreement at the federal level that screening results in improved health outcomes. And so there has not been a federal program established similar to the breast and cervical cancer screening program. But this is the first time they have awarded funds for prostate cancer screening, and we're one of only a handful of states that did receive a grant.
Ms. Kelly, can you clarify, is the grant, and it's a new grant, really new grant, it says July 13th, 2007, so this is kind of hot off the press, but the $170,000, is it for education and outreach, a kind of a public awareness, or is it for screening?
I'm unclear. Madam Chair, it's public education and outreach. It is not for screening. So there is no federal funds available or state funds available for screening.
That's one last question. You know, do you receive grants for other types of cancer to do outreach? I mean, is the breast and cervical cancer the only one that you receive federal funds for, or, you know, where have they sort of decided that line should be?
Madam Chair and members, my understanding is that the breast and cervical cancer program is the only funding we receive for cancer screening. We do receive federal funding for our comprehensive cancer program, where we evaluate people, you know, strategies to reduce the incidence of cancer, but breast and cervical cancer is the only place where we do receive funding for screening.
Well, this has been a good dialogue, I think. I want to thank you for coming, Mr. Ng. Thank you, and a good dialogue. This will be discussed some more. There is a bill, and maybe we'll be hearing this time. It's not the budget year, but I think this has been good for the panel and part of our discussions going on. So who's next?
Thank you very much. Item 2 on our agenda. Wound care. We have a whole host of presenters. I won't go through them all, but I invite you to come forward.
Pull up enough chairs. Eric, can I help him get some chairs?
Sure. I understand that you have a PowerPoint that you will take us through. I'm not sure who your lead spokesperson is, but if that person could identify him or herself for the committee, that'd be great.
Thank you, Senator Lynch and Representative Abler. I'm Dr. John Melke. I'm a practicing internist and geriatrician in the metropolitan area. My practice is with Aspen Medical Group, and I'm also a medical director at several metro facilities. And I'm on the board of the Minnesota Medical Directors Association. Thank you for allowing us to come and present today. My goal is to introduce a formulary process that we have in place in several nursing homes at the current time, designed to introduce high-tech therapies and diagnostics into what is really a low-tech environment. And so I hope to introduce this to you and answer questions. when I thought about what does it take to bring new technology into what is a fairly low-cost environment, it needed to meet a true medical necessity. It had to be portable. It had to be something that was available at the nursing home because of transportation costs. It had to be easy to use. We have 50 to 80% turnover in long-term care, so the training needed to be easy. And we wanted it to be overall cost-effective, not just reimbursable. I think too much of our long-term care environment has been driven by what can we get Medicare to pay for, and we wanted to move beyond that. So those are the foundational principles. In dealing with wound care, there are standard approaches which every nursing home really takes to heart and tries to do. They include staff training, documentation, wound interventions with dressings and so forth. Most places have a wound care team and do the necessary monitoring to report wounds out to CMS. Our formulary approach seeks to include important new high-tech principles, devices, along with web-based learning and monitoring tools, automated reporting of outcomes, and by keeping it in the facility, not in a hospital wound clinic or a surgical suite or some specialty center, it helps build staff morale and it keeps it resident and patient-centered. This is what it looks like diagrammatically. You have a nurse at the bedside that measures the wound, assesses the patient, puts the materials into our database, and uses guidelines then to use what we describe as generic dressing products, but also when to apply these high-tech diagnostic and treatment tools. Then we monitor compliance and input the data, and we can graphically display the outcomes. When I started to look at this process, I decided that a number of lower extremity wounds were probably being misdiagnosed as pressure ulcers, which shows up on the scorecard for nursing homes in a negative way. And by doing ankle brachial index testing, which defines peripheral vascular disease or arterial insufficiency, we can move a number of those so-called pressure ulcers into a different category. It alters our treatment, and it helps the nursing homes not take blame for what is essentially an endogenous patient problem. So we're using in a number of facilities this machine. It's made by Omron, and with four blood pressure cuffs, one on each limb, and a patient who can lie still for 45 seconds, we can generate a form that looks like this, and in the bottom side it gives you an ankle brachial index, and if normally it should be one, the blood pressure in the arms and the legs should be equal. If it's under 0.8, there's vascular disease. If it's under 0.5, there's severe vascular disease. So it alters our expectations of the healing process in those limbs. And it does specifically change the kind of treatments that we ought to be doing in the feet. The other technology that's really quite remarkable, and I've been using it now for 2.5 years, that is at the core of this formulary, is pulsed electromagnetic frequency therapy. When I first heard of it, I thought it was voodoo medicine, just one more flash in the pan thing. And my director of nursing here, Kathy King, said, I've seen it work. We've had 10 patients who have had pressure ulcers come and go. Where her medical director had read about it and brought it into their facility. And she said, none of those ulcers came back after we healed them. So I said, okay, but you've got to prove it to me. There's very good basic science supporting this, that it stimulates fibroblasts to multiply. It's been FDA approved for edema and pain reduction in the lower extremity. It came from bone stimulators where trying to heal bone fractures, they discovered that wounds on the lower extremities healed in the same field. And so it was studied more, and this is what it looks like. It's basically a cantaloupe-shaped field of energy that's been in the lab determined to be optimized at 27.12 megahertz, and it's pulsed frequently over a half an hour, and the treatment happens twice a day. You just have to put a coil on the patient's skin and push a button, and this energy is delivered. There are some smaller randomized controlled trials that show that this works. There's not been any large New England Journal of Medicine type controlled trial, but in the lab, when you apply this to fibroblasts, you can see them multiply. And I just have a few pictures. My apologies to the non-medical people, but this lady lived in one of our long-term care facilities, and for 2 years her leg looked like this, in spite of our best efforts at doing proper bandaging, trying to reduce the edema. And in 3 months, she healed up her leg and lived for about another year and a half with the wounds gone in both of her legs. This is the first patient that was treated in the Twin Cities, a 54-year-old gentleman who worked as a bricklayer, and he had diabetes, lost his little toe. He had osteomyelitis in this location, that is bone infection, and was due to have an amputation in about 2 weeks. This device just became available here. It was used, and in 2 weeks, the surgeon said, I don't need to trim any more dead tissue off of this. Let's see how things happen. And by the end of the summer, on September 1st, 3 years ago, this was healed up. He continues to work and has his leg still attached. This is a lady at another long-term care facility who had this appearance. This is called venostasis dermatitis from edema. And she'd been followed at one of our better hospitals for wound care and still had a wound that looked this raw. On the top left picture is a close-up, and after 3 months of treatment, the bottom left picture shows that the skin is healed over, and most of the skin in this treatment field has become intact again. This, of course, reduces the amount of time dressings are needed, reduces the infection risk, and allows for more mobility. A patient of mine had a hip fracture, and then unfortunately, as often happens with vascular insufficiency and being at bed rest, he developed a heel ulcer. The orthopedist called me just before we were installing PEMF and the formulary at this nursing home, said he thought he should have an amputation, and his ankle brachial index was 0.45, meaning he had severe vascular disease there. Again, within 3 months, we had this heel closed, and it stayed closed, and he continues to have his leg. This is a lady that really is in the nursing home largely because of this wound. She was unable to take care of herself at home, refused vascular surgery, continues to smoke, continues to sit with her leg down in the wheelchair, but was waiting for PEMF to come by, and we started it. Now, she's not going to have a dramatic result, but the next picture just demonstrates physiologically what happens in these wounds. Every little dot of redness that has a white glint on it is a little bubble of new tissue growing up, and that's called granulation tissue. This hasn't happened in this woman's leg for 5 years. We've been fighting a losing battle. And now I think we have hope of re-epithelializing some of this area. As part of our formulary, we don't just count wounds, we actually measure them and measure the progress that we're making. And I think from the committee standpoint, this is really what I would like you to hear, that we want to institute this, but we have a way of measuring outcomes and giving feedback to the Department of Health, to regional managers of nursing home chains. And this is, I think, unlike any other program or sales opportunity that I've seen. We believe that our formulary must be outcomes-based. So we measure these week by week, and then we can plot out the closure rates on the diagram on the left and the volume or the percentage to closure and the volume reduction. And we have our website in beta testing so that we can do this across multi-facility organizations, allowing administrators and regional managers to assess the quality of the wound treatments that are happening in these buildings. Just one recent data on cost. Northridge Care Center is represented here in the panel. In 2005, our dressing costs there were $78,000. We used one particular type of dressing. In 2006, we used the same type of dressing. We had the same wound care team, essentially the same processes, except we added PEMF, and our dressing costs, as measured, decreased in exactly one half. This is a slide just demonstrating how we can track the data in a facility. And so this facility measured some of the patients who were receiving PEMF and other patients that were not. And the number in the middle of the page is percent closure per day is 5% with the treatment and 1.4% without the treatment. So it's one facility's initial data on does this work, and we plan to have this, or we are doing this in many facilities. Just a spreadsheet looking at physician billable codes on debridement and amputation, and our goal is to so effectively treat these wounds in diabetics and peripheral vascular disease, pressure and venous stasis, that these kinds of wounds will, or these kinds of charges will diminish substantially as time rolls out. So our formulary approach is dependent on provider training. As many of you know, the long-term care facilities are so stressed now that many of the nurse trainers have been converted to other activities or put on the floor, so training is fairly minimal out there. We want to look at and evaluate technologies that reduce healing time. We're looking at a silver spray that kills all known pathogens in wounds that's cost-effective to apply. There's a recent journal article in the American Geriatric Society that looked at ultrasound evaluation of skin, and the presence of subcutaneous edema is a predictor of skin breakdown. So we're already in contact with the manufacturers of that ultrasound device to see if that should be added to our formulary as a way to identify which patients coming from, say, the hospital or home should be put on specialty mattresses or have special attention paid to their skin. The measurement data supports all of us around the table with the necessary data to know specifically whether we're having quality outcomes. And then Kathy King and I are responsible for looking at wound care opportunities to continuously update these guidelines. We hope that the committee looks at this kind of process favorably and what we're asking for. I thought that was actually on the last slide, which you may have in your packet, but I don't have here, that's asking for the state to provide case management funds directly to long-term care providers who adopt this kind of formulary approach to pay over and above what they're getting on their daily rate for Medicaid patients. We believe that that's going to be money well spent based on these statistics. And the last line on that slide says there's a guarantee. And what that guarantee implies is that if these numbers don't support the expenditure of those monies, you can stop the program. We will have the data and the support to show that the quality supports the expenditure of funds to support this industry that could use a little help, frankly, in this area. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mielke. Questions or comments from the committee?
Senator Lynch, thank you for your testimony. Actually, Senator Paul Coring has some questions he wanted to ask of you, but I think I, first of all, need clarification of what you're presenting to us today, and I apologize that I didn't get it, but are you suggesting that we create a formulary approach for DHS to measure effective technologies that we can use in this particular case, wound care, and then we'll adjust the payment? Because I'm not quite tracking. Is the formulary approach the actual diagnostic new equipment, or is it a process?
The formulary is a process that includes the placement of equipment and measurement tools in long-term care. We are currently doing this in 20 nursing homes in the state of Minnesota. We have a couple of nursing homes in Illinois. And so it is a model of care that includes the measurement tools that are already in place, that includes guidelines that are available on hard copy and soon to be in a web-based learning model for any caregiver in the home to access. So it's a process that's in place and already includes measurement and the diagnostic and treatment equipment that I've mentioned already.
Okay, that helps clarify a little more. Do you see DHS as having a role here then in terms of doing the evaluation, or who actually is creating the formulary evaluative?
It's created. It's Advanced Healing System has the process in place.
Okay.
And I think that the money that we're asking for could be used broadly in nursing homes. It certainly could support this kind of a formulary process. One example came to mind. Just this week, hospice patient with skin breakdown needed a better support surface. And hospice sent out a device that, as I looked it up on the internet, cost $149, and it was an inch and a half plastic alternating pressure pad. On the website of this company, it says this is designed for prevention or stage one ulcers. This patient already had a stage 2 going to stage 3 or 4 ulcer, and the hospice was only willing to supply this. The nursing home took that away on my advice because it was, I think, inappropriate, and supplied a $1,500 low air loss bed at their own expense. So already nursing homes are doing a lot of behind-the-scenes at their own cost, additions to the care for wounds. But I think DHS will have a clear role in looking at these numbers and saying, are we getting our money's worth?
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask one of Senator Coring's questions and not hog the whole conversation?
Ms. George, how about if we go to Ms. Stein, and then if your question hasn't been answered, we'll come back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm just looking at the recent data on cost. If we're looking at cost containment, I just wanted some clarification. That was on this page in the diagram. You identified that the 2005 dressing costs were $78,000, and that you're saying that this process reduced the cost to $39,000 for the dressing, or is that the aggregate cost of treatment of these clients? I mean, did we, by using this technology and adding the cost of the technology to the nursing services, you were able to reduce the cost of care in half?
Those were simply the dressing costs that diminished. So it wasn't the total cost. It was that it did reduce the dressing cost by that much.
Do you recall, Madam Chair, Doctor, do you recall the cost of this PEMF? I assume that spreading it over the number of clients that are that are served, that it's a cost-effective tool, even adding that in here.
Right. Madam Chair, the cost of implementing this formulary in nursing homes today is 34 cents per patient per bed per day. So for a 100-bed facility, it's $12,000.
Now you've got me confused. So these are leased, and then that's what they charge, or do they buy their own machine? Is that the idea, and then they train their staff?
The Madam Chair, the cost of 34 cents per bed per day covers the lease cost. It's a 42-month term, but that includes all the data management tools, our staff training, and the use of the ABI machine, and then the monitored outcomes back to the facility. Does not include the cost of dressings or other modalities. So it's essentially the lease cost of the machine plus the value-added services that we provide.
I guess I'll stop. Go ahead. Why don't you, Mary Jo, you want to ask one of your questions?
You know, I think I can answer these. Believe it or not. See you afterwards if I can't. How about that? Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Well, let me go back to my question. I was just trying to respect the absent senator here who had questions. Maybe you'll just get the answers through the cosmos. But I heard this presentation, and actually this is updated version, but I think it's great you're pursuing the long-term care thing. Our division of cost containment, 2 years ago now, I think we were very impressed with what you were earlier on, and now it's moved along as things do with time, and you have an application and a request for some money. So it seems that the money that you're suggesting that the department would pay as part of their rate would kind of offset the cost. But the nursing home is going to be ahead, aren't they? Who wouldn't want to do this? If they got that money, or even without the money, why wouldn't you want to do it? Because you'd save money. Even if this, because if you've been here very much, you understand fiscal notes. And a dollar times however many zillion people days we have in the system adds up after a while, and then you have to find the money and haggle through a great pain here. So who wouldn't want to do this?
Representative Abler, I'm Kathy King. I'm the director of nursing at Minnesota Masonic Home in Bloomington. I can speak to that. Dr. Milky referenced before that I recommended the program to him. I used it at a different facility, and with working with Advanced Healing, we were the first facility to try to use that. And what we spent a lot of time trying to do was figure out how to get paid by the state, or how to get paid by Medicare, or how to get paid by anybody to use the machine, because the machine costs $20,000. So in the interim from when I moved from the facility that I was at until going to Bloomington, Advanced Healing was able to come up with a different plan whereby the facility does not get reimbursed for utilizing this program. So this is money that we're spending And we're spending because we believe that it helps us get better outcomes. And what they were able to do was come up with a program that you will be able to have the PEMF machine in your facility to treat wounds at a cost of 34 cents per bed per day, with the support and training and other things that they have to provide. And my organization, we feel that it's very cost-effective for us, but we also feel that we would really benefit from having some additional reimbursement because we are the ones doing the case management in the facility at an additional cost that we're not reimbursed for.
And do you find that compared to the other method, which is your control leg, which is going to abscess more and more, and you, if you blow on it, hopefully it's better what you're doing in the one that didn't work, but is it more staff intensive to do the treatment with this thing than watching the other one that you didn't under the old way?
Representative Abler, the answer to that is that what I learned early on using this program is that you have to have somebody that's in charge of the program that's monitoring and measuring it and making sure that it happens. And so basically you need to have a dedicated person in the facility that's managing the program. Now, that doesn't mean that that's all that they're doing. Generally, we call them a wound nurse, and they usually do a lot of other things as well. But basically that person then is the one that keeps track of making sure that the data is kept and that the treatments are working. So it does take additional staff time.
Thank you.
I'll just comment that I think, as applicable to some other organizations, perhaps outside of long-term care, that I've seen sort of a theme over time of this is maybe today or going forward how we deliver services, and there's a gap in how we are compensated or not compensated for those services. And so I really commend you for trying to work through that and bring forth a proposal that seeks to get to that. Because I believe that there are a lot of people sitting at these tables in this building over the summer that are seeking to find ways to close some of those loopholes.
And I think you raise a good case study about how do you take a new innovation that actually works and break in to actually make it become customary. And that's, good luck as you do that. It's not as easy as I thought it would be for this technology, so I wish you well.
Thank you very much, and we'll look forward to working with you again at another
time. Thank you for your time.
We will move along. I'm trying to watch the clock. To number three, pay for value. And it's a special privilege for me to have Dr. Doug Wood with us today from the Mayo Clinic. I think his presentation will continue, will be a nice segue into continuing that discussion on how do we compensate or provide payment for some of these services in what we now maybe feel are as unconventional means. Dr. Wood, welcome.
Well, thank you for the welcome. It's nice to come across the street. I work on Senator Lurie and Representative Murphy's one of the other cost containment work groups. So I think the fact that there are at least three groups working should tell us something about why it's important to achieve cost containment. So I'll talk a little bit today about some aspects of pay for value, which I think the first two presentations, in fact, began to frame very nicely. I'm going to share with you actually results of work that we have been doing at Mayo across the country, and I thought this would be a good time for us to bring some of those ideas here for you to hear and think about how you might apply them to a state of Minnesota solution. So these are not really intended as specific recommendations, but rather they're intended as a framework from which we may be able to begin consideration of how we can achieve cost containment in healthcare in Minnesota. The problems of the healthcare delivery system are not new to any of us. In particular, efficiency as well as just rising cost are major concerns, and the two presentations so far, I think, attest to the contribution of both of those elements. So what are we learning at Mayo? Last spring, some of you were probably privileged to attend the opening Mayo Clinic National Symposium on Healthcare Reform. There will be a closing symposium this spring in Leesburg, Virginia, but in between time, we have hosted four forums across the country. And as we've gone around the country, we have asked participants to craft for us a series of their recommendations, and we have tried to rank them by urgency and importance. And this graph, which you have in your handout, should help to highlight those findings. But the most urgent and most important is considered to be building public and business mandate for national change. That often requires leadership position in the legislature in particular, as well as other citizens in the state will have responsibility for that particular job. Transparency among systems and practices is something the legislature here, I think, has already addressed. Perhaps the most nettlesome circumstance here is to define what is an essential benefit package or define what are essential health care services. Whether you do this on a national level or whether you begin to consider this on a state level, as has some other states in the country, Oregon, Vermont, Massachusetts, Maine, to name four, this, again, is something that we probably have to consider with a fairly high degree of urgency and importance as well. Now, we're going to talk today about results-based reimbursement with a patient component. That's value-based payment. Other factors, including the formation of integrated systems, as well as rewarding consumers for choosing high-quality plans and providers, were not ranked as high in importance or urgency. There were four forums that we have hosted, and they have addressed the specific issues of insurance for all, effectiveness and efficiency in clinical care, integrated care, an important part of medical home, a concept that's being addressed in our work group, and then last, pay for value. And we'll talk about the pay for value a little bit more. But just to highlight some of the findings in terms of the first forum, this really began to refine the employer's role in providing health insurance and shifts away from a health insurance program that's based on employer-based insurance to one of individual ownership, providing portability and accessibility, covering an essential package of benefits with an ability to purchase more services. And then actually supervised by an independent health board to determine the package, similar to the Federal Reserve. Now, this is a national recommendation, but I think that actually the first two presentations began to suggest why you might want to do this in a non-political fashion. So these same discussions that you just heard, actually, I do a lot of work with Medicare, have been going on at Medicare for a long time. And what happens is that you tend to try to make some decisions about what you want to use. You then add additional cost pressures to the system without knowledge of what actually is going to work in a large population in the long term. So to the degree that we address things on an individual basis, we tend to miss the opportunity to make more informed decisions about technology utilization. So our vision here is creating an organization for healthcare in the country based on the recommendations we've heard around the country. And in that circumstance, we're dealing with an expectation that it is everybody, so we have to begin with universal coverage. That means adequate insurance that is affordable. There should be high-value healthcare as part of that. It should be patient-centered, also an expectation of the Institute of Medicine, based on teamwork. And the last presentation, I think, was an extremely good presentation in terms of where teamwork becomes quite helpful. Professionals using information technology and systems engineering to improve processes, something that healthcare has generally lacked, and an ability to learn from each other, assimilate new evidence that can benefit individual patients. The clinical trial that was referenced as part of the prostate cancer as well as ovarian and other cancer evaluation, a long clinical trial taking a long time to enroll and follow up patients, it would be a shame if that evidence was not assimilated into clinical practice in a really short time. If it takes us as long to assimilate the information into practice as it did to gather the information, that would be a tragedy and a substantial waste. Our respondents suggest that there are three essentials to get to the vision that they have described: equity, patient-centeredness, and value. Now, equity includes basic insurance for all with an essential benefit package that's defined by this independent health board, with additional services and coordinated options that they can have and own for their lifetime and take with them wherever they might go, not dependent on a job. It will be necessary, too, that we provide for the needy, and that will require then state or federal action. And a part of that may need to be policy or legislative alteration or rehabilitation of a tax treatment of insurance benefits. From the perspective of patient-centeredness, there are two dimensions that we have heard from our respondents as being extremely important. Accountability must occur at the level of the provider or physician. That provider is responsible for achieving a high level of health, a high level of satisfaction, and providing value to the patient. But there also is a growing expectation around the country that we hear from people in our symposiums that says that it's now time for individual patients to accept accountability as well. In fact, for those of you who know much about Galen Wagner's chronic health care model, it in fact emphasizes having a truly activated patient and a caring and activated physician together. It is not a one-way street proposition. In addition, it is important that patients understand their accountabilities to adopt healthy lifestyles, follow the treatment regimens that are recommended, and also accept fair financial responsibilities. You may think of this in a different way, something that we considered at Mayo several years ago when we were looking at our own healthcare costs, and that is that simply we are all part of the problem, but we are all also part of the solution. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Part of this also includes choice, that is, options that clearly detail and are easy to understand in terms of options and responsibilities, without surprises that limit coverage at the time that you are confronting a healthcare decision, something that is unfortunately a terrible surprise to many people once they become ill with a major condition. There should be informed treatment decisions. We'll talk a little bit about shared patient decision-making that can help patients and physicians together make decisions about their health care. And we'll talk about how that can have an impact on overall cost. Integration, coordination of care is an absolute necessity. Again, in our work group, we're spending a lot of time working on the concept of medical home and how it can be the focus of coordination of health care. And we're trying to also come to some degree of scorable results that can go into a fiscal note so that we'll have some dollars that we can put to achieving universal coverage at the end. So I don't know if we'll manage to do that job in the next 3 or 4 weeks or not, but it is expected of us anyway. Information technology, you've seen some of that already, can provide some ways to improve care, but it also has to be practical and patient-centered so that patients can use it to make appropriate decisions. Our vision is that this should occur at the point of care, and the point of care may not necessarily be in the context of an office anymore. Most of what we do in medicine is now based on on physician office visits. That's what's paid. But increasingly, we don't need to pay for physician office visits. We don't need to pay for bricks and mortar. You can do a lot of this work with electronic systems. And so, in fact, we can provide better value for patients referring physicians from an organization like Mayo, utilizing electronic resources to help make decisions. Some of the components of bioinformatics are summarized here, but there must be for every patient a personal health record that they can access and help maintain. It should incorporate access to information about what they should do for their health, as well as an understanding of their own disease burden and the risk that they face in confronting chronic diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease, and others. We can actually also share with patients the results of our treatment programs. We can share with them what we would anticipate their risks to be. And you can, in fact, share with them aids that can help them make decisions. So earlier today, we heard about the discussion of prostate cancer. So if you were a male and discovered you had prostate cancer, Mr. Eng described 3 treatment options. He didn't describe the 4th, which is observation and no treatment. It is reasonable in some of those circumstances that you simply watch and not do anything. But those are things that we can then share with patients and help them make a reasonable decision about which option is best for me in the management of my disease at any particular time. And last, with more and more technologies coming at us with advances in basic science that we can apply to diseases like cancer and cardiovascular disease, even diabetes, we can help patients make appropriate decisions. And if we combine this with good outcomes and health sciences research, we can help make some informed decisions about those therapeutic interventions that are likely to yield the best outcome for the dollar paid. And that result then hopefully will translate into lower overall costs over time for society. So the value equation here then, we have represented as outcomes plus safety plus patient service and a cost over time. Now, generally, physicians are paid now not on a time basis. They are paid on a unit of service basis. There are some that are not. I mean, for example, I'm paid a salary, so it doesn't make any difference to me how much I do or don't do. And physicians who work in other groups may be paid in a similar fashion, but most physicians, more than 85% of physicians in the country, are paid on a fee-for-service basis, where the issue simply is the volume generated, not the outcome that you generate over time. Now, value has to begin with transparency. Some physicians around the country have raised concerns about whether or not malpractice concerns are a significant driver of healthcare costs. As we've tried to study this nationally and have tried to take advantage of other studies, it appears that the cost may not be as high as has been suggested. PricewaterhouseCoopers suggests it might contribute to about 10% of total cost, but I'd emphasize, too, that there are no good hard studies that are available that allow us to say simply finding a solution to tort reform will, in fact, provide dramatic savings that can be used somewhere else in the system. There are also some expectations that we have to improve healthcare delivery. We have too much of individual delivery practice that goes on in healthcare. That's a reflection of the small practice. Most practices in the country are four or five physicians at most. Those of us who work in large practices like the Mayo Clinic can take advantage of a systematized approach. We need to be able to take this actually across the country, and it needs to be part of physician training. We must be able to innovate and both from research and education apply new treatments that we can use to increase value in healthcare. Now, in order to do that, changing the way we pay providers is probably the single most important consideration of moving forward. You heard from Dr. Melke and his colleagues the difficulty of getting paid for new technologies, again, in this country that are based entirely on a fee-for-service circumstance, not on the basis of outcomes that are achieved over time. So in effect, how might we do that? We need to define payment systems that could provide patients with nothing less than they need, but really no more than a fully informed and cost-conscious patient might want. And again, we need to come back to value for providers. So at Dartmouth, we actually asked people to rank several kinds of payment reform as to their importance and whether or not they should be developed. The current Medicare approach, which actually pays for performance, received pretty low grades. It really doesn't do anything to improve quality. It's just a matter of reporting, and it requires creating a lot of administrative structure to do the reporting. Mayo, by the way, is not participating in the Medicare program because it will cost us more to do the reporting than they would actually pay us for providing the quality. So just interesting little observation. Perhaps more important are the ones that are on the bottom of the list, and I circled two that I'll talk about here a little bit more, mini capitation and shared decision-making, for their importance. So shared decision-making, and I'll use an example from cardiology since I'm a cardiologist. But in this circumstance, we would envision that candidates for elective surgery would be offered an educational program on their disease and its treatment options, and medical centers who use this approach would actually be compensated for making the program available and using it. Now, of course, you get compensated only if you do the surgery. So there's an obvious incentive there to do the more expensive sort of thing. But here's an example of revascularization therapy, particularly coronary artery bypass grafting, that's CABG, and angioplasty for each million population in 2002 in the United States and the United Kingdom. You can see that in the United Kingdom, this kind of intervention is done for coronary disease less than 20% of the time it is in the United States. So you might ask, why is that the case? It is all personal preference, really. I'll come back to that in a moment. But here is the evidence from Mayo and Olmsted County. We do more than the United Kingdom, but only about half of, as much as done in the United States. Now, some cardiologists would argue that we didn't know this answer until earlier this spring when the results of the COURAGE trial, in fact, were published. The COURAGE trial randomized patients to medical therapy versus angioplasty or bypass surgery. But we've had other trials over the years since the 1990s which have shown actually the same result. So it's not the first and most surprising. Now, in terms of patient-shared decision-making, what is the impact? In the United States, where this has been evaluated, Jerry O'Connor and his colleagues in the New England Conservatory, New England Consortium looked at the ability of patient-shared decision-making to alter selection for surgery. And in their patient cohort, they were able to reduce the number of people choosing surgery by about 30%. That would have a dramatic impact on overall cost. If we think then about how we might approach payment from a different perspective, there is the concept of mini capitation. Again, rather than providing payment on the basis of fee-for-service for every little thing that you do, hospitals benefit from this to some degree in the outpatient arena, but hospitals actually have been living under the concept of bundled payment and the concept of DRGs or prospective payment since 1983. Now, the payment actually has gone only to hospitals. It has not gone to physicians. So what is different about this, actually, is we're talking about a payment that goes to the hospital and the physician together. And this may be extremely important in achieving the development of systems capabilities in the bulk of medical practice, not in places, again, where there's a system like Mayo, but in places where there may be a large hospital and several practices that support the hospital. This is a concept that might be able to extend some degree of system-related function and improving payment in that regard. But what we're talking about here is a single lump sum payment that would go to the hospital and physicians, and they would have the responsibility of working together to achieve the best outcomes. Now, why does this have potential? 1% of the population accounts for 30% of the cost, and 10% of the population accounts for nearly 80% of the cost. So in the current circumstance, especially in the federal side of administered pricing in Medicare, every year we go through and create these large rules for prospective payment, inpatient, and for physician payment, where we administer the pricing for about 700 DRGs and 7,000 procedures. By doing a bundled approach for a chronic disease, you'd only have to do that for a few chronic diseases. Maybe 30 at most would cover 80% of costs in chronic disease, and it might even be fewer conditions than that if we did the analysis carefully. But this would avoid getting bogged down into really trying to adjust the payments for all services. There is some interest around the state as well as the country in looking at pricing, and in the state of Minnesota, you know that there are websites where you can go and look at prices. Now, unit prices may be deceiving, and let me illustrate for you. Here is an example of coronary angioplasty where the unit price for the physician's fee is 10% different between Team A and Team B. You might be inclined to quickly pick Team B. However, the practice pattern and style of Team B is different than that of Team A. Team B uses a lot more ICU days. Their costs per episode are actually 17% higher. And by virtue of their attractiveness on unit price basis, if they were to command more of the market, we considered how much of our total healthcare resource they would have consumed, they would have consumed 105% more resources per million population than the other team that appeared to be less valuable on the basis of a unit price analysis for a procedure. So this comes back again to the concept of value. It's the outcome over time, and it's not simply the unit price of a specific procedure. The total costs that we all confront really reflect the price times the use, and what we have to do is find ways that we can attack the use rate. We can try to attack prices, but the Medicare program has done that in spades over the last 15 years, and their disappointing results have been that their costs are continuing to rise at rapid rates. It's really, again, coming down to utilization. The last concept about utilization is that of a medical home. We're working on that in our work group, but we believe that it has substantial promise in terms of being able to manage chronic diseases. There are some cost estimates that we're trying to develop in our work group that we can attach to the medical home. I can talk about those a little later if there happen to be questions. But I believe that having a medical home is one of the ways that we actually can find a way to reduce overall utilization. when you consider chronic disease, the reason for this is that there are a large number of older patients that have more than one chronic disease. And when you look at each one of those patients, they have a large number of physicians and a large number of prescriptions. And the problem with this, of course, is that with so many physicians or so many cooks, you can imagine that there's a lot of duplication of ingredients, particularly when you're looking at the prescriptions. The outcome may not be as good as you would like because you get into conflicting issues about recommended treatments as well as recommended medications. Some of you may remember Walter McClure, who was a policy analyst for Interstudy here in Minnesota. And some of you might be thinking to yourself, too, although there are not very many people old enough I see around the table, haven't we been there before? Well, we sort of have been there before. And Dr. McClure used to say that you could take your pick. You could have either high quality and easy access to the latest technology, but not low cost. Or you could have low cost and high quality, but not the latest technology. Couldn't have all three. As we've gone around the country and talked to people about what they think the possibilities are, more and more people think that we can have all three, but it's going to require concerted effort. And some of the respondents think it may require almost a big bang of sorts to rehabilitate our healthcare system. But in order to get all three, we would need to have providers improve their effectiveness and efficiency. Payers change fundamentally the way they pay from volume to value. For patients to become active participants working to achieve better lifestyles and better compliance with therapies for chronic disease. And the government actually needs to find a way to drive payment policy again away from an administrator. This is a federal issue, by the way. It has an effect on the state level, but this is more of a federal issue. Medicare in particular needs to be able to drive away from administered pricing on fee-for-service to something that actually comes closer to a bundled payment or mini-capitation, which they cannot do without an act of the Congress. But if you could do all of those, then probably you could have actually all three of the desired outcomes from a healthcare delivery system. So I appreciate the chance to share at least some philosophic thoughts. We hope that the ideas that other people have been sharing with us around the country might be helpful to you as you're beginning to sort through the options that you have in front of you and sift through the suggestions that you've heard in the meetings you've had so far and the ones that are to come. In particular, I think as all of us begin to put our ideas together from all of the work groups and the Access Commission has to start beginning to make some decisions about what we're going to do in anticipation of the session, these higher-level thoughts might help you frame a more generalized approach that will give us a good, solid policy that we can build on in the coming year that will achieve, I think, the goals that all of us have, which are affordable health care insurance for all Minnesotans that provides high-quality care and improvement in their life. So with that, let me stop, and I'll be happy to take questions at the discretion of Senator Lynch and Representative Abler.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. Two things, I think. One, Dr. Wood has once again reminded us that there are some federal constraints that are certainly sitting as a large umbrella over the work that we do. And secondly, I think for the first time, at least from my perspective, I'm starting to see from work group to work group, there's starting to be some lines that are, or some dotted lines that are being connected. And that's, I think that's exciting. I can see that there's something that's going
that to
starting
kind
to come,
thing?
Come together. But Dr. Wood, I will open it up to questions and comments, but maybe while people are thinking about that, I want to ask you to go back to, you had a slide about the 58% to 41% to the 30%. And I didn't follow you there, so could I ask you to just...
Which one was that?
It's on page 6. They're not numbered.
It's on my page 6, but...
That one. So here's what this slide means. So that in New England, in the 1980s and early 1990s, a group of hospitals worked together to improve cardiac care for patients. And this was the Northern New England Consortium. What they tried to do actually was to improve the likelihood that physicians and patients could choose the right treatment for coronary artery disease. They did this actually with creating shared decision aids, which they would hand to patients, and it would describe for patients something like this. You have coronary disease. The pumping function of your left ventricle, the main pumping chamber of your heart, is normal. That tells us that you're going to have a good prognosis no matter what we do. The only thing that we have to consider is how much trouble will you have with the symptoms of angina, shortness of breath and chest discomfort. We can treat those symptoms with medication, with bypass surgery, or angioplasty for that matter. If you opt for medication, you don't have to worry about the risks of surgery, the short-term disability, the potential of infection, the immediate potential of a perioperative death. If you opt for surgery, you might have a better outcome for a short time. That is, you might have 5 or 6 years with little or no angina. But at the end of 10 years, you'll be having angina again because your bypass grafts will have occluded. There is no likelihood, there is no less likelihood that you will have a fatal heart attack after 10 years with surgery than you would with medication. So based on your own preferences about how you might want to do things, you can make a choice. Either way, this was truly an option. So what was very interesting in that circumstance is that when you looked at how many patients then would opt for surgery with shared decision-making compared to just listening to a cardiologist or surgeon describe what you should do from their perspective, not from a shared decision-making perspective, 41% of patients opted for surgery when using shared decision-making compared to 58%, nearly 60% of patients who opted for surgery just listening to their doctor. That's a 30% reduction. Now, you might ask why. You could probably all contemplate why that might be the case. For those of us who have watched physicians interact with patients, some of you have been patients and have interacted with your physician, may readily understand. Sometimes as doctors, we don't get the explanation out in a way that makes good sense. It's got too much medical jargon in it, and we don't take the time to really try to help people understand what their options are. But that's what shared decision-making means, is that you, where there are options, and there are quite a few options. Again, the prostate cancer example today is a really good one. So what you would do with that is you would say, okay, you have prostate cancer. And we would expect that if we don't do anything, you will live about 20 years. Based on the stage of your prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. You could decide to treat it. You could do radical surgery. And that radical surgery may not make you live any longer. It may leave you impotent and incontinent of urine. You could opt for radiation therapy, which may also not make you live any longer, but may leave you with substantial bleeding from the rectum months after the treatment is done. Or you could opt for medication, including hormone therapy, and here are the different things that could come from that. That, again, is a condition for which shared decision-making is actually very helpful because you have truly options in many of those circumstances. And patients actually should have an opportunity to make a choice. I think, as Mr. Eng reflected, there are personal differences. Some patients will opt for surgery. And if that's a reasonable option based on what's available, that's quite in fact, reasonable to do. Some will say, I'm perfectly comfortable watching and waiting, not having to worry about the pain or surgery or the risk of impotence or other surgical risks. That sort of patient-centered shared decision-making is probably going to be one of the most important things that we can do to reduce the overall cost of healthcare, because a lot of this what this is called preference-sensitive care, by the way. This is the best example of preference-sensitive care that you can see. A lot of this thing is, in fact, what drives costs. So it may seem innocuous to do screening. But once you've done the screening and then you have a false positive result, you have a lot of biopsies and a lot of other things, And then you get to a treatment decision. And again, you can see here that if physicians are actually driving the treatment and they're not providing adequate information to patients in as transparent a way as you can, you're going to drive people toward a more intense form of therapy. Because, again, that's how physicians are paid. They're paid to do the surgery. I don't mean to say that every surgeon is in it solely for the money of the operation, but I think you can tell that unless you actually have a structured way of doing the shared decision-making, you may not get the information presented in a way that allows people to make a reasonable personal choice.
Thank you. Ms. Sexton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Wood, you know, I was looking, your final recommendations ranked by urgency and importance, and you put the number one is building public and business mandate for national change. And when I find that interesting, but, you know, it seems to me in working for the business community here in Minnesota that there has been that push for change, and maybe it hasn't developed to the point you'd like to see it, but I think a lot of the frustration comes from the business community perspective, and now learning about that side is the sort of unwillingness to actually move change, both within the provider community, the purchaser communities, the employer communities. You know, I think we all have a stake in this, but what... I mean, maybe you can provide a little bit more insight into what you see as building this public and business mandate.
Right. So these responses actually were ones that came from participants at forums across the country.
Okay.
And they came from people who were business people, providers, legislators, state and federal, scholars, other interested individuals. So what we're reflecting here is what we're hearing from people in terms of what do they really think it's going to take to move things forward. Some of us, I think, have a clear understanding of where we want to be, but it might be important to remember the results of a Kaiser Family Foundation of satisfaction with health insurance in 2005, I think. But in that national survey, more than 80% of people were satisfied with their health insurance coverage. Now, I think what that reflects, actually, is there is a little different sense of urgency among some people than there are others, and the uncertainty that some people might have, well, if there is some reform, does it mean that I will lose something that I have already? I think that will be potentially one of the challenges that we face as we begin to move forward and think about how are we going to make collective decisions in the state that will allow us to do these sorts of things. I think if you consider the implications of these recommendations that reflect the output of the symposium that we've hosted around the country, there is a pretty profound set of implications that would say we're going to shift away from employer-based insurance to individual insurance that is individually owned and carried. And there are a lot of implications to that if a single state decided to do that. Some states, I think, have already begun to have that discussion, have already made the decision. And is it time for us to do that in Minnesota? Maybe it is.
Ms. George.
Thank you. Dr. Wood, this is about the second time I've heard your presentation, and I really enjoy it, and I can't agree with you more that I think as nurses we really believe we need to look at restructuring the payment system, absolutely, in terms of some of the incentives. But one thing I'd be curious about is if you guys have given any thought to how do we get our arms around sort of the growth in technology and the medical arms race? I mean, I feel like today... Usually I sit on that side of the desk because I'm not an elected official, but I felt like the presentation we had today, we're not equipped to make these decisions in terms of what is effective, cost-effective new technologies. So you talk about sort of an independent panel that might look at creating an essential benefit set. Would you consider creating some sort of structure independently that would look at technology growth or areas like that, because that's one area I would like to see this group kind of look at as system change.
I think that's a very good question. The respondents in the symposia have, in fact, identified that we need to have some sort of technology assessment that we have dropped. I mean, we used to do it to some degree. I was a founding member of ICSI in Minnesota back in the early 1990s. We had technology assessment in ICSI.
Okay.
And then HTAC came along, So there may be some of us who remember HTAC, Healthcare Technology Assessment Commission, I think was the exact title. It tried one thing and then basically ended up quitting. But we will have to do some sort of technology assessment. It needs to be evidence-driven. When new technologies come along, we need to apply them in a structured fashion. So rather than simply saying everybody can go out and use this, mm-hmm. we would say it has to be used in the context of clinical trials done at hospitals that understand how to participate in clinical trials and can enroll a large number of people in a short time. Patients who participate in clinical trials would have potentially access to the intervention. So it's not that we're denying access to anybody. So anybody actually would have access. Mm-hmm. There would not be a prescription to payment. Some payment plans now say, well, you can't do that because we don't know if it works. Well, sure, we don't know it works, but we're going to need to have a lot of people to make sure that it works. Mm-hmm. But we don't have anything else, so you're going to be paying something anyway. So in that circumstance, let's just understand that it's part of the total cost of health care, and we will create trials, and everybody is eligible for trials, and there should be no denial of participation in a trial that seems appropriate. That might require some regulatory change in the market, a specific recommendation that we might make in one or more of the work groups. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the best way that we're going to understand information about what, in fact, works. Rather than, and I think that is more important than trying to make decisions legislatively or in a regulatory fashion. So some of us may remember some earlier examples of treatments, high-tech treatments for cancer that people thought would make a big difference, and we said, well, you shouldn't deny people access to this treatment. Well, unfortunately, the outcome of that was that it didn't make a difference. That is, it didn't save lives. In fact, it may have ended some lives prematurely. Once we put a piece of legislation in effect that said you had to have this as an option, it made it nearly impossible to enroll people in clinical trials to get the answer. So it took longer to complete the clinical trials to provide the answer. It would have been better just to say, you know, we don't know the answer. Anybody with a disease can participate in the trial and be paid. Just cover being in a trial. Don't say you have to actually have it, per se. That, I think, would be a much better long-term solution in terms of getting to technology, better managing technology diffusion and adoption.
And Ms. George and Dr. Wood, members, we are going to, at one of our upcoming meetings, it's not the next one, but okay. We are going to dive right into that very issue. So stay tuned. Very quick, Ms. Sexton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm intrigued by this mini capitation piece you put out, and I notice you sort of limit it to looking at major acute episodes.
Right.
Is there an opportunity, and I sort of link this back to the transparency piece, and I know you've put that out there, but it's one area that I think my membership at least continues to struggle with actually finding good, transparent information, especially on cost. Quality is getting better. We still have a long ways to go there, but I mean, has there been any talk about looking at this package pricing for things, say, like maternity care or, you know, the not necessarily the acute pieces, too? And have you guys had any of that discussion in these forums?
Well, the concept that's coming out, I think, of the forums and this concept of mini capitation basically begins to get to some degree of package pricing. So you could think of it as, maternity care is a fairly good example. So you pay for that based on an anticipated set of requirements for an uncomplicated pregnancy that you know is going to have a limited duration. But if you took heart failure care, for example, you could say, okay, based on a patient's burden of illness at a particular time, you could say, I would anticipate that we would need to spend $7,000 this year for medications and maybe one hospitalization to cover this patient. If the ejection fraction, for example, was less than 30%, you might then say, well, this is different. So now I know I'm going to have to spend almost $70,000 because I should put in an implantable defibrillator for protection from sudden death. That's going to cost a lot of money this year. But you could potentially package care in that kind of way. You'd have to decide which conditions to do it for. And I think there are some conditions, at least based on my experience and what we were hearing around the country, there are some conditions for which we have enough information that I think we could begin to make some judgments about putting packages together.
Ms. Stein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions that are kind of related, and I'm trying to think of how to say them real quickly. One is, isn't one of our big problems that we are working on an insurance system that was created to serve acute problems, and now we have a system of needs that are chronic? So that
answer number one is yes.
Yeah.
And so potential options to treat that are something like mini capitation, where you get away from the fee for service that's acute based.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So since my memory is short, then you can go to question number two.
Okay, because the second one is kind of related to that, and that's that can we really reduce costs of care instead of just reducing the increases? And I use as an example a cardiac example. My father-in-law died of a heart attack. My husband, who has kind of the same, you know, has been good at exercising, doing all the right things, but he is also on several medications that are costly, and he's living well, and it costs. It's a healthcare cost that is greater than it was 20 years ago. The outcomes are better, and I'm assuming that if my son has the same problems, we're going to have more costly treatments that are going to improve his quality of life.
That's a complex answer. At a large level, at a truly macro level, if you contemplate all of the care that you might then require because you have extended life, depending on how long a person lives and how much you have to discount the value of a current dollar, you might not actually save costs over a person's lifespan. Now, where the opportunities are, however, are really in secondary prevention. So if you take the example of having a heart attack, aggressive management of risk factors to lessen the likelihood of a subsequent heart attack and maintain normal function will, in fact, reduce subsequent costs over the next several years. We did a project at Mayo with John Deere and Company back in the 1990s in the Quad Cities of Iowa. And we were able to show that for diseases of that nature, you could, in fact, show some fairly significant short-term savings by applying best care for patients with heart attack. Another example that we learned in that one was if you had a patient with diabetes who was complaining of abdominal pain, don't spend a lot of time doing lots of diagnostic studies. Actually, go see a cardiologist first. The reason for that was that there were a lot of heart attacks actually that had been misdiagnosed, and if you just figured that problem out, you actually could save some money in a short term. There are some things that we're doing in our other work group which actually come back to this too, and there may be the opportunity for sharing some of those things. So in the presentation that I made about medical home and our work group at the beginning, we tried to estimate based on some experience that we've had at Mayo, as well as some analysis of Commonwealth Fund state report card data. There are some ways that you can actually begin to project savings for the overall system. Now the challenge is, how do we actually be able to convert them into scorable savings that we can, again, put in the fiscal notes? And I'm not going to be able to figure that one out alone, but I'm going to trust the legislative research staff to be able to go on what we're working on to help with that.
You're helping us to get there, Dr. Wood. Ms. Morant, did you have a quick question?
I don't know if it's quick, so I don't. My question was about care coordination and where it should be located from your perspective.
Dr. Wood. Really, this has been done in a lot of places around the country. It's been done in some places in Minnesota already. It can be done in a physician's office. Mm-hmm. It can be done with a nurse practitioner. But it needs to be somebody who is going to be committed to that patient and has a continuous healing relationship and is available and can help make decisions. Now, some specialists could do that too, but my sense is it's going to be largely primary care providers who will do that, physician and or nurse practitioner.
Thank you.
Members, thank you very much. I think there's some good discussion today. We will be meeting next week, next Tuesday, September the 11th, 1 o'clock p.m. in room 123 of the Capitol. Right? Thank you very much. We will be adjourned. Okay.